Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're joined tonight by the legendary stand-up comedian Jackie Mason, who's been making audiences laugh, gasp, wince, and think for a long, long time.
The greatest painter, in my opinion, who ever lived was Michelangelo. Why? Because he painted the whole Sistine Chapel all by himself. By himself. Now, there were thousands of people with brushes. He could have said, "Mister, help out. The ceiling needs painting. Take a look." But he never asked for help. Did the whole ceiling all by himself. Took him 30 years because the man was a schmuck. Let's take the issues of the world today. Let's start with Africa. What is the main problem in Africa? Libyan terrorism. It's happening primarily because of the issue of Palestine. It expresses the frustrations of the Arabs because they cannot fight Israel on equal terms. Because Israel turns out to have the toughest army, man for man, in the world today. The toughest army. That's a fact. I was in Israel. I saw that army. I couldn't believe it. I thought they were Puerto Ricans. The show is not about sex, and I'm proud of that fact. I'm proud of the fact that this is the only clean show probably on Broadway or any place else. I don't think there's a clean show left anyway outside of this show. Every show today is about one thing, sex, and sex, that's all you hear about. And every show, we're living through a period of the vulgarization of American standards, American culture, American entertainment. Everything became sex. Every major novel today is about sex. It's all you hear about. Every major movie, sex and sex. Why don't they talk about something else? Why don't they talk about music? Don't you think music is more important than sex? I mean, for men in your condition. Let's be honest. All four people once had cockroaches. I'm not picking on them. If you're Jewish or Italian, there were once cockroaches in your house too. Let's be honest. The only people who never had cockroaches are white Protestant American Gentiles. They never had a cockroach. You know why? There's no food in the house. Well, let's be honest. How much can a cockroach drink? You cannot kill a cockroach in a Gentile home. It's always drunk. It's here, it's there. A Jewish cockroach you could kill in a second weighs 300 pounds. Just ate a prune Danish. Boom! And then.
Whether it's cockroaches, Homeland Security, or the Dixie Chicks, Jackie Mason jumps in with humor on the offense, and he's done it for decades, since his early days as a Borscht Belt comedian. Born Jacob Massa in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, to a family of rabbis, Jackie Mason grew up on Manhattan's Lower East Side and himself studied to be a rabbi until he gave it up for the life of the stand-up comic. Today, with an unprecedented half-dozen one-man shows on Broadway, over 18 years under his belt, Mason is still a comic on the prowl. His latest one-man show is entitled Prune Danish because, he says, a prune Danish is always fresh, never stale. Tell that to the baker. Jackie Mason has crossed some wild American decades as an equal opportunity offender. He makes us laugh, cringe, and think about American status symbols these days, war in Iraq, visions in the White House, and yes, the prune Danish. Tonight, fasten your seatbelts. We're looking at the world according to Jackie Mason. You can join the conversation. What's your question for the comic who's been down Broadway and around the block for almost 50 years? What's your first memory of Jackie Mason? What does Jackie Mason speak to for you today? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is stand-up comedian, world watcher, connoisseur of the prune Danish, Tony Award and two-time Emmy Award winner, Jackie Mason. Good evening and welcome, Mr. Jackie Mason.
How do you do? How do you do? I'm trying to figure out if I'm such a sensation all over the world. What am I doing here? Waking for nothing. I can't figure this out myself.
Yeah.
I was so impressed with this introduction, I forgot that it's me you're talking about. I wanted to leave the room and look for the guy who's doing that great.
We know who it is, and you're right here with us, and we're awfully glad to have you.
Well, why not? If I had news for you, if you could get a big sensation like me waking in an empty building with you.
Just the two of us in the middle of the night, Jackie.
I try looking at each other without knowing if there's anybody showing up or not. I won't be surprised. This is not even a radio show. It looks like an empty building, and they cornered me with one Gentile. And all I know is I can't get out. There's 12 producers watching the door.
Well, you're cornered with one Gentile, and off we go. Let me take you back to the... I don't know if you heard this, but at the very top of the hour, we started out with this story. I don't know if it's apocryphal or not. You tell us. Of Ed Sullivan, and this is from this new book. I don't know if you've seen it, by Gerald Nachman. Seriously funny. You're a lot in this book, and he cites this incident. He says Sullivan supposedly sent Jackie Mason wandering nearly 20 years in the comic wilderness for allegedly flipping him the bird during his act when Sullivan indicated off camera that Mason had only a minute left. Jackie Mason, true or false? Is that the way it happened?
Well, the truth of the matter is it's an idiotic story, and it was a total preposterous misunderstanding. Ed Sullivan was panicky and nervous because President Johnson was on the air at the time about the war in Vietnam. Mm. And it was a live show at that time.
Right.
Now there's no such thing as primetime live shows, but this was a live show, and Johnson was about to come on the air, the president, and he's watching a short comedian telling jokes, and he's frightened and panicky that somehow I'll encroach into the time of the president. Now, I thought the president is nothing compared to me, but he didn't think so. He thought it's more important to hear the president. I said to myself, from the president, nobody makes a living. He only costs you a fortune. There's no jokes. You ought to thank God that I showed up to replace him. Instead, he was sweating and desperately making sure that I don't somehow invade the territory. So all of a sudden, he starts showing me two fingers, and a highly placed two fingers, so for everybody to see, and him telling me that I got 2 minutes left.
Two.
So I started to imitate his fingers because I was losing the audience. Everybody was watching the fingers, right. And they forgot that I showed up.
Ed Sullivan's sign language is taking over.
Right, the sign language took over, so I started to imitate his finger gestures. And he claimed that I was giving him a filthy finger gesture, which I never even heard of at the time. I had only been a rabbi 6 months before that. A rabbi doesn't make a living from filthy gestures. That's not how I made a living, and I didn't even know what it meant at that time. When I tell people now that I never even knew what that gesture meant at that time, they think either I'm phony or naive or stupid or crooked or liar. They can't imagine that I really didn't know what the hell he was talking about.
You grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, right. And flipping the bird meant nothing to you? You didn't know what it was?
I came from a very religious Orthodox Jewish family. I didn't know the Lower East Side from the tough guy neighborhood types from the wise guys and the lowlifes. I didn't know about drinking, smoking, drugs, addictions. I didn't know about commonplace characters. I never heard a dirty word till I was 22 years old.
Give us the story. It begins in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, a town I know. How did you've got a family, great-grandfather rabbi, grandfather right. rabbi, father rabbi. Rabbi, three of your brothers rabbis. Right. You trained as a rabbi. But how does it begin in Sheboygan? My
father came from Europe to Sheboygan because he was a refugee from Russia who was escaping pogroms in the Soviet Union, and he was under the aegis of the Hayas, a Jewish organization that was protecting Jews in America, and finding them jobs in small towns because almost everybody on the Lower East Side was a rabbi. So if another rabbi showed up, there was no place to work for a living.
So you're out there on the edge of the Great Lakes.
So they had to find jobs for these people. So they found him a job as a rabbi in a town where they never even saw a Jew before. It was a rabbi without a congregation. And we spent all our time in the search of a Jew. They never heard of a Jew in that neighborhood, and if they heard of him, they'd said to themselves, this is, we got to grab that. If they heard of a Jew, the only purpose was to wipe him out.
And
they
so,
said, where do Jews hang around? They said they showed him the tree.
So the Sheboygan chapter did not last long. You were back in Manhattan.
So after we came to Sheboygan, and my father was a practicing rabbi there,
yeah.
He found that there was no place to practice and there was no way to make a living. And furthermore, he was desperate for his four sons to become rabbis, and there was no way to be trained to become a rabbi. Among a small town of 37 Gentiles, two hookers,
and a lot of ships from Lake Michigan.
One church and two Ku Klux Klansmen sitting at the door waiting for us to show up. So there was no way to make a living there. But as soon as he found the opportunity, he dragged the whole family to New York, and there we were with 3 million other rabbis trying to break through and make a living.
You were a cantor, you trained to be a rabbi, and then you didn't.
Became a rabbi, and I was a practicing rabbi.
Yes, but for a very short time, and then you were gone. How did it happen?
Well, I was only became a rabbi to please my father. I was never religious, and I'm not so particularly religious to this day. I don't disdain it. I don't want to give the impression that I look down upon it. I think it's a beautiful story. But I personally have never found any great conviction about religion because I say to myself, I'm a great humanitarian. Everybody tells you need religion to help people. But religion has killed more people than countries have. Mm. More people have died from religious conflict and religious persecution than any other reason. If you put together the nationalistic wars compared to the religious wars, nationalistic wars pale into insignificance compared to the death and destruction of religion.
Hands
now,
down.
This is, you could claim that religion has noble and idealistic purposes and spiritual, everything about it is spiritual, beautiful, fantastic, but in practice it turns out to be the greatest excuse man ever found to kill each other.
But you didn't leave...
Atheism. If you want to have a successful world, we should have atheism, because there's no such thing as an atheist killing another atheist because he's the wrong type of atheist. Did you ever hear an atheist say, I'll kill that atheist? Why? Because I don't like the atheism he belongs to? There's no way to place
no,
to belong if you're an atheist. And they can't tell the difference between one atheist and another. And if you're prejudiced, you don't know about what. So if you want to kill somebody, you don't know why.
Jackie Mason, you didn't stop being a rabbi because you were a peacenik. You had this comic thing going on the side, if I'm not
mistaken. Well, the main reason that motivated me to become a comedian was that because I became a rabbi, and as I was practicing as a rabbi, I noticed that every time I delivered a sermon, I would get huge laughs, because it's appropriate to get a laugh in the middle of a sermon.
Now, why?
People hope and pray when they see a rabbi that he shouldn't be boring.
Please,
the first thing
please,
they
God.
Think of is, oh, how spiritually boring this is going to be. They want to feel spiritual, but they don't want to really hear the speech.
Yeah.
They don't want to go through the spiritual significance of it because it's very heavy-headed. Most people are not that religious, but they want to feel religious, but they would rather hear entertainment when they get there. Especially Jews, when they go to temples, they're not looking for to hear a speech about religion. They come there to compare coats, to compare nose jobs.
But
they
wait
come
a minute.
There to compare
but
who looks older than who.
But
who
humor, humor goes to truth also, doesn't it, Jackie Mason?
Right.
I mean, humor will
of
take
course,
you there.
Of course, humor takes you there.
But the
fact of the matter is that every time I tried to be funny, I was getting screams and laughs, and constantly the congregants kept saying to me, why aren't you a comedian?
And you
rabbi,
asked yourself.
Rabbi, you ought to be a comedian. I kept hearing that. And I was looking for a job that was something different than a rabbi because I wasn't, by conviction, a real rabbi.
Yeah.
I was doing it to please my father, but I felt like a hypocrite because I would admonish people not to look for pleasures of the flesh and not to run around with women. And as I was telling them that abhorrent, it's abhorrent and disgusting that people just think of good times and that sex is vulgar and relationships of that kind are basically immaterial, disgusting, obnoxious. Oh, yeah. You could die from this, thank God. And all of a sudden, a beautiful blonde would walk by and I'd lose my place. I forgot what I was talking about.
Well,
I said to myself, this is disgusting for you, but for me, this is what I wanted. So I was living a hypocritical standard of life.
And you fixed it. Jackie Mason, you've got a new show you're doing. It's called Prune Danish.
Right.
I guess an allusion to all of that culture that so much of your humor comes from. Give us a sense of this. What's on your mind in your new show? I know one thing you're thinking about is American status symbols. Why? What?
We always talk about the hypocrisy of status symbols and the preposterousness of status symbol values that everybody lives by. Everybody pretends and convinces themselves that they're only interested in things for practical and significant values, for the good reasons that make logical sense. Turns out that almost everything somebody does, and I make big issues out of this in all my shows, almost everything everybody does is phony. It's just to prove to themselves that they're richer than you, to let everybody else around them know that they can afford a bigger house than you, a bigger car than you. And people would rather be caught dead than be seen with a Chevrolet. If a guy thinks of himself as a rich man and you catch him with a Chevrolet, he has a whole speech prepared. This is not my regular car. I don't know how it got here. I don't know what it's doing here. Did you ever meet if I do this in my act about a Mercedes? Do you ever see a person who has a Mercedes who admits that he buys it as a status symbol, that it makes him feel rich?
No,
I never saw it. They'll all tell you, I buy it for the engineering. I can't find one Jew that knows a goddamn thing about engineering. When is the last time a Jew became an expert? They can't turn on the radio, but they're experts in engineering. I make a whole routine out of all these fake status symbols.
But you've been watching Americans for a long time. Are we more lost in status symbols now than before?
I don't think necessarily. This kind of a culture has always been obsessed and absorbed with only one thing, who's richer than who. And everybody spends their whole time racing for the bigger house and the bigger boat and the more fantastic car, and it ruins their life, and they don't even know it, because they're so obsessed with trying to prove how rich they are that they spend their whole life in debt to something they never needed in the first place. As soon as a guy can comfortably afford a certain house, he buys a bigger house that he also can't afford.
Back in debt.
Now he's back in debt. And they go from one debt to about a house to another, and the whole parade of houses means nothing in the first place. As soon as a guy can afford a $100,000 house, he's looking for a $200,000 house because he's embarrassed that he has such a small house. If he has a $1 million house, he's envious of it. They never reach a level where they're not envious of a guy but a still bigger house.
Same with comedians?
What about comedians?
The same endless search for the bigger joke, the bigger laugh, the bigger crowd?
No, the search for stardom is something there that's a basic part of every entertainer's life. Every entertainer is by nature sick. If you're a normal person, you can't be an entertainer.
Jackie Mason, hold that thought. We've got to take a short break. We're going to come back and speak more with comedian, world watcher, and connoisseur of the prune Danish, Jackie Mason. You can join the conversation. What's your question for the comic who's been down Broadway and around the track for almost 50 years? What's your first memory of Jackie Mason? What's the state of political humor today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jackie Mason is still on. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're joined tonight by comedian, world watcher, and connoisseur of the prune Danish, Jackie Mason. Comedian extraordinaire, what's your first memory of Jackie Mason? What's the state of American political humor today? Does Jackie Mason make you laugh or wince or both? Is that a comic's job? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jackie Mason, here you are. I've got you quoted. You say, and this is just about the track you're on before we had to go to the break, you say, it's hard to find a normal comedian. This is a very, very insecure, nerve-wracking business. Everyone's on an ego trip. Most people don't become comedians because they want to entertain people. They only become comedians because they feel rejected and nervous and helpless altogether. Quotes attributed to you. What do you mean, Jackie Mason?
That's basically true. There's a great tendency for comedians to be very sick people. Because if you ever watch a kid who's trying to entertain every time, and always trying to be funny, tries to be the life of every party, you usually see a person who's deprived emotionally. Either the father can't stand him, or the mother doesn't talk to him, or he has two older brothers who just punch him in the mouth every 20 minutes. He's the rejected kid who's having trouble getting attention and feeling respected. And he's saying to himself, where can I find affection if I can't get it at home? He either looks terrible and they're abusing him in the school, or they're making fun of his looks, or his weight, or his height, or his breath, or his armpits. Something about him is not working.
Was that you?
I positively. See, I'm not like you. I'm an honest person. I tell the truth. People find it hard to believe that there's something wrong with them. Everybody likes to attribute everything they do to some noble purpose. Nobody wants to feel that maybe there's something wrong with them. That when a guy runs for president, did you ever see him admit once that he just enjoys the power? What else would it be? Who's going to sacrifice their whole life to try to become a president of the United States and take upon themselves the most heavily burdensome job in the history of the world, to be troubled all day with human misery about death and destruction all over the world, and be dying for that job? If somebody told you, here's a job, and describe a job of a president, and this is what's going to be your problem, who's starving, dying, who's got tuberculosis?
Miserable job.
Right. Would you say, that's the job I want? You would say, you got to be in a sanitarium to even suggest it.
Only for the power. But Jackie, I try to be an honest person. A lot of people do, but maybe, finally, ultimately, only comics can be.
That's probably true, because only comics can have the nerve to tell you the truth. And if you say these truths that I'm saying now that so are self-evident, it doesn't require a genius to see the truth in it. If you say it to a person directly, as an individual, and you say it to him as an accusation, that's his real motivation and how lopsided it is compared to his pretensions, the first thing you'll do is attack you and say it's impossible. It's impossible. Everything you say is disgusting because it's not him. Maybe it's other people, but not me. If you tell me you married this girl because she's beautiful and you couldn't get over the fact that you got such a stunning girl, could you think one guy will admit it? They'll say, no, she's so brilliant. She's my best advisor.
It's her mind, it's her soul.
Her soul, her heart, her spirit.
So smack us around a little bit here. You are the famous equal opportunity offender. You've been watching the United States in politics for a long time. Now, how are we doing? What's the truth we don't want to hear right now, Jackie Mason?
Well, the truth we don't want to hear, I don't know what the truth we don't want to hear, but I could tell you that the truth is that by far the majority of the people who are the peaceniks of this country are either sick or stupid. Or they're just plain arrogant and obnoxious.
Why?
Because it's a beautiful thing to be against war. But when they're against war, they become irrational. They're against anybody ever defending themselves against anybody.
So war in Iraq, you say, you were saying gung-ho, let's do it?
I'm not saying whether you should have done it or you shouldn't have done it, but they didn't even consider the possibility that maybe we should. They didn't even stop to wonder how guilty is Iraq of being partners with the Al-Qaeda and fomenting terrorism. How many lives are they costing? How many ways are they fomenting it? In what ways are they funding it? In what ways are they partners with it? And how many lives will be saved by attacking Iraq? I'm not saying we should have, maybe we shouldn't have, but they never considered it for a second. All they know is if you're involved in a situation that might lead to a war, you're disgusting, and they started marching without knowing the first thing about it. Who's the main marchers and the great fighters against war? The Hollywood community of actors who are collectively probably the lowest IQ of any profession in the world.
You know, Jackie, though, I have heard people on this show who marched against the war and who did know a lot about it, but I also did meet those who said, on the face of it, we don't want war. We've got to mature as a species. We've got to get beyond war. What are you saying? Can't we ever get there? Isn't that a reasonable goal?
Kind of a dumb thing they tell you. They tell you, listen, we have so many problems in terms of education in America. We have so many roads that are not built. We have the infrastructure problems of this country. The infrastructure is falling apart. We're going to spend the money defending ourselves or fighting a war against the country when school education, when the classroom is that size? As if to say, if you could take care of the classroom, all of a sudden you'll wipe out the Al-Qaeda. You have to do something about the fact that people are getting killed all over the world. And the question of what to do about it never enters their mind. Never enters their mind. I'm not saying they're wrong. Let's assume they're right. But they're irrational, unreasonable, and unthinkable.
Maybe. I think you can go to war for irrational, unthinking reasons as well.
Of course, you could do that too, Rogue. But I'm saying the people, I'm talking about that side and that type of thinking. You ever talk to the Hollywood people who are against the war and are furious about the war? Did you ever hear one cogent, sensible argument, an organized reason that moves logically from one point to the other?
When you ask them, why are you against
the war? They have no idea where the country is. If you ask them where Iraq is, they'd probably point to Pittsburgh. They don't know anything about anything. Who's more ignorant than an actor? An actor could sometimes be a brilliant person. Most, but brilliance has nothing to do with getting him the job.
Jackie Mason.
You could just as well be an actor with an IQ of a cockroach. Who is the biggest stars in the world? People like Shirley Temple. At the age of 3, you could be a star. Could you be a statesman at the age of 3? Could you be a nuclear physicist? Could you be anything with a responsible job at the age of 3? The only thing you could be at the age of 3 that's great is an actor. Shirley Temple could be as good as Paul Muni.
Jackie Mason, you're uncompromising when you get going. You're uncompromising. Israel.
I'm never uncompromising.
Oh.
There's one thing about me. I hate an opinionated person, and I was never opinionated. I even said to you that there might be an argument for that side, but they never present an argument that makes any sense. They never organize an argument. They don't have any basis for an argument because they don't have the intellectual capacity or the study of it to even know anything about it. They never made a rudimentary acknowledgement of the basic problem involved because they know nothing about it. Ask the Yentas in Hollywood what would the war in Iraq was about, and ask them what the issue was, and ask them about terrorism and what we should do about it. Do they know how to answer it? Do they know why you shouldn't fight terrorism? Or do they know any alternative to fight terrorism? Did they ever make a study of what the alternatives are?
You know what, Jackie Mason? I don't have the heart to only talk about war with
you. I never heard an intelligent world from an actor about anything.
Smack us around on something else. Let's let the war aside for a second. Right. Bring us home. At home, when you watch Americans living, interacting, talking, working, living their lives, you've gone after us on status symbols. Okay, we got that. Where else are we a little bit naked, a little open to the Jackie Mason treatment these days?
Well, I talk about all the hypocrisy in the world. I talk the hypocrisy of the average parent who's always making sure that their child never drinks, never smokes, never says a dirty word, while he lives exactly the opposite life all his life. He's training you to make sure that you do nothing that he does all the time. You should reject everything because it's immoral, but it's good for him. The greatest fear a parent has is that a child should see how the parent is behaving. Every time they talk, they say, get him out of the house. We're talking now.
We have to have a real conversation.
The greatest fear is that every time they have a drink, they say, don't let him see it. So they're hiding from their children all the time. They want morality only till you're 17.
And then good luck to you. We're talking tonight with comedian, world watcher, and great stand-up, Jackie Mason. You can join the conversation. And Jackie, about 2.7 million people want to do that. I want to turn to the phones, if you don't mind. Daniel is calling.
2.7 million people listening to this show.
No, but it looks like everybody on the planet's calling in. I'm making up a number. Come on, I'll be that honest.
You know, you got about 11 people listening.
Yeah, right. They're all on the phones right now. In the case and more. Daniel's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm a fellow atheist Jew, and I have a question about that.
Okay.
I noticed that most of Jackie Mason humor, and at least in my mind, is a lot about being Jewish American experience.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that there aren't so many younger comedians, younger people talking about that these days. And it seems to me that a lot of that is because Jewish Americans these days are really just more like everybody else, more like regular Americans. I wanted to know if Jackie Mason agrees with me and if he thinks that there's been something lost there.
It's a great question, Daniel. Thanks so much for calling in. Jackie Mason, what about it?
I wouldn't say it's a great question. It sounds like to me like a pretty obvious question. I don't think this man has proved any great intelligence with this question, but I don't want to insult him.
He obviously means well.
To say that whether you're younger or older has anything to do with whether you're talking about Jewish Americans. The fact of the matter is that to this day, right now, Jews at every age still behave differently than Gentiles. Their culture has something to do with their behavior, and just because it's not as severely true, it's not obsessively true as it was 30 years ago, doesn't mean it doesn't exist now. Are you going to tell me the average young Jewish kid is just as likely to become a coal miner as a Gentile? Is he just as likely to become a football player as a Gentile? How many Jewish football players are there? Is he just as likely to be fixing a flat tire as
but
a Gentile?
Daniel's asking, is comedy drifting away from that as a subject because Jews are becoming more assimilated?
Well, it might be. I don't know. Maybe it is. It's not the reason.
I mean, you've embraced it. You've made it central.
Assimilation is one of the reasons because these kids hang around with Gentiles a lot and are much closer to them socially than the people were. Their separatism in denominations, religions, and races doesn't exist today to the same extent that it did 30, 40 years ago. Blacks and whites mix much more comfortably together than they did before. People are friendly with homosexuals without thinking of them as idiots or maniacs. Gentiles don't look at a Jew as a guy he has to get even with all the time because he has too much money and he's going to follow him home 4 o'clock in the morning to see if he can wipe him out. There are still some pockets of discrimination, but it's probably a minor factor in our culture today compared to what it was 30 years ago.
I'm reading here.
How often do you see a person get nauseous and nervous because you're a fagala? If a guy is a homosexual, God bless him. As a matter of fact, they respect him more than the heterosexual. They look at a homosexual as a guy, who knows, he might rearrange the furniture. They're fascinated with homosexuals. They called him a maniac.
I'm reading here in the Jewish Advocate from this week. It says, to Mason, comment is no joke. Former rabbi upset about criticism from Jews that his humor is too Jewish.
That's a sickness of Jews who are embarrassed by their Jewishness. I've said this all my life, and it's true to this day. Very often you're going to see a reformed type of Jew, and he becomes a reformed Jew because basically he likes to convince himself it's a philosophy of religion, but the real purpose is not to feel too Jewish. And as soon as you remind him of his Jewish background, his Jewish sound, his Jewish neighborhood, his Jewish culture, or his parents, his grandparents, that reminds him of being a refugee, of being an outcast, of being unacceptable to the Gentiles, of being somebody who doesn't quite belong, and because he doesn't feel like he belongs, he's struggling all the time to look and sound and talk like a Gentile. He puts on brown shoes, white socks. He tries to talk English perfect. Hello, you have to go to the toilet.
So 50
and
years from now,
he tries to lose his identity as much as possible.
Are we going to have Jewish comics 50 years from now who build the heart of their comedy around the experience of being Jewish in the world, being Jewish in America?
I don't think so. They probably won't, because little by little, as it diffuses more and more, they'll be less and less involved with that issue.
Yeah. Ron is calling from Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for taking my call. Hey, what I want to say is, who's the other whore? I'm an unreformed Jew. My wife is the first one. We want to know who's the other one so we can put her out of business. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Ron, we got it. Jackie, I don't know if you even remembered, but you said in your opening stuff what was it? Your dad moved to Sheboygan and there were two whores, and I don't know what, and Ron wants to know. Well, Ron's joking with you, my friend.
I was just kibitzing and trying to say that there were people there, that there was no Jews there. There was just a strange element of anti-Semites hanging around there. At 56, 60, 70 years ago, by far the majority of Gentiles in this country were anti-Semitic. Then they were racist towards blacks. If you take the statistics of how many people would give equality to a black person today as 50 years ago, it's upside down. How would live next to a black person? How many people would give them a job? 50 years ago, a black person could have been a genius, and he was still relegated to being the janitor in the building. Mm-hmm. A woman couldn't get a job above a secretary. We all know that this is a simple fact of life, that almost every discrimination was rampant in this country, whether it was intentional or not. People didn't even feel like they were discriminating. It was so much part of the culture that a woman did not belong at equal times with a man that they treated them as though they were a lower species of humanity.
Wisconsin's responding to you, Jackie Mason. Kostas is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Kostas. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. It's great to actually be talking directly to Jackie Mason. I must say I'm excited. I have his tapes. I didn't buy his tapes. Somebody copied the tapes and gave them to me.
Uh-oh. They copied your tapes,
Jackie. You're ashamed of yourself. But you steal my tapes and you're not ashamed to tell it to me. What if you stole my furniture? Would you be on the air telling me about it?
Well, actually, I'm copying one of your lines from your stand-up routine. But like I said, the main comment I have is that I'm a fan. I love your sense of humor. And I saw you in London about 8 or 9 years ago. And you haven't changed. You're still young. And my serious comment for the conversation is that you seem to suggest through your comedy that Jewish people, the Jewish community in general, and I will enlarge it to minorities altogether, seem to try to be successful in business. I'm Greek myself, and they seem to be successful in business or in the arts as a way of coping with discrimination, as a way of making themselves successful in society because they feel separate.
Maybe it's the only way.
Yeah, and well, I will take my comments off.
Kostas, we got it, and thank you so much for your call, Kostas.
What he's saying is very self-evident and obviously true. Jews have always tried to overcompensate for their feeling of being an alienated minority by trying to achieve. Achievement has always been the major stress of every Jew, to try to prove to themselves that they got so far in life that they can't be rejected or neglected because of their success. That's overcompensation intensity of the Jews is all over their faces. I could almost always tell a Jew just by looking at him. He has an erotic look that a Gentile doesn't have.
And you say maybe he's got to have it. Jackie Mason, take us on a little tour here. Help us. I don't know. What should we look at? Let's look at the Democrats. We're going to have another presidential race. You've seen them. They're getting together. The nine were together recently debating. Right. And there they are. Joe Lieberman right in the middle, maybe leading in the middle. Right. What do you think of this gang?
Of Lieberman?
Okay, start with Lieberman.
Well, I have not very much respect for Lieberman because I found Lieberman to be hypocritical in a million ways. First of all, I find that he might be very good in terms of his policies, of his basic idea of what the country needs, but I find that he personally has been underhanded and semi-crooked in a lot of things he's done.
Well, first of all, that's the way a big charge, what?
First of all, the way he uses Orthodox Judaism as a way to funnel all the attention to himself.
He gets respect for observing it.
But the truth of the matter is that he makes an issue out of it and as he symbolizes it with his behavior, that he doesn't travel on a Saturday. But every time he does something, he makes an exception for himself of all the Orthodox rules and regulations. He violates every Orthodox rule and always tells you the same thing. I got a special dispensation from a rabbi. There's no such rabbi who has a right to stop the religion from working, to violate the religion.
But this could be the first Jewish president. Wouldn't that please you?
I couldn't care less if it's a Jew as a president or a Gentile. I don't feel there's any necessity to have a Jewish president any more than a Gentile. I don't feel that a Jew is going to do anything more for the Jews than a Gentile would. I think if a Jewish president was there, he wouldn't be more concerned than Ronald Reagan was about Israel or more protective of the minorities, including the Jews, Bush does right now.
All right, what do you think of that man in the White House, George Bush, George W. Bush?
I think so far he's been a very effective president, and I feel another thing that's very interesting, that even though he's comparatively inarticulate, people are therefore very quick to decimate his level of intelligence, as if how exactly you talk proves exactly your level of IQ. If that's how you judge the IQ, then Albert Einstein would be considered an idiot compared to a used car salesman. And I find that Bush is decisive and determined, and he's well organized as a person who knows what he wants to get done. And because he doesn't know too much about everything, he knows exactly how to find the people who do know everything. And he's chosen the best people, and if they help make the decisions and make everything effective, then I don't care if he's doing it or the guy next to him is doing it. Meanwhile, it's getting done in the best way by the best people.
There's a vote for W from Jackie Mason, our guest tonight, comedian, world watcher. You can join the conversation. What's your question for the comic who's been down Broadway and around the track? Does Jackie Mason make you laugh or wince or both? And is that a comic's job? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're joined tonight by comedian and world watcher Jackie Mason. He's got a new one-man show. It's called Prune Danish. He's with me in the studio tonight and a lot of fun to have right here. You can join the conversation. What's your question for the comic who's been around, who's seen a lot, who's maybe seen it all? Does Jackie Mason make you laugh or wince or both? And will American comedy always wear the Boris belt? Are you glad for it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mark is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Good evening. Mr. Mason, you make me laugh and wince. I'm one of those that you do both, but that's a great thing. Tom started to ask about your opinion about the Israeli-Palestinian crisis, and I'd love to hear your views on that subject.
Good. We'll get it. Thanks, Mark. Jackie Mason.
Well, you know, every show of mine is different than this show. I'm talking a lot about this Palestinian issue, just like I'm talking about Iraq and airport security and all the things I never talked about in any previous show, because I don't like to deal in yesterday's jokes, and people didn't come here to hear a comedian talk about what happened 12 years ago. Every time you see a comedian who's more than 20 years old, you start hearing jokes from 20 years ago. And I think people are nauseous, and that's why they hate to go see a comedian more than once, because they know if they see him again, even 30 years later, he's still telling the same jokes, like he never read a paper, he never heard the world changed, he never heard that the Titanic was sunk, he never heard who was president after Abraham Lincoln.
But Jackie, Israel, Palestinians, it's happening right now. People are looking for some kind of breakthrough here, hoping.
But I was just in London, and I was doing a Royal Command performance for the Queen. And after I did this Royal Command performance, because I talked so much about Israel and things like that, I was invited to talk to Parliament. And this, I was remarkably honored, because Parliament never involves comedians in their meetings. You don't exactly hear this as a place for Jackie Mason. But I was awed and stunned that almost all of Parliament came out to see me that night to hear my views. Of course, they thought they'd be entertained, but meanwhile, I used it as a soapbox to talk about Israel, because I think that the biggest idiotic fraud in the world is the moral equivalency that they keep giving throughout the world to the Israeli position, and as they do to the Arab position. They don't do that when America's involved. When we are attacked by the Al-Qaeda and we have terrorists bombing our buildings, nobody says that there is a moral equivalency between us and them. We went there to Afghanistan when we bombed out a whole country, went to Iraq and bombed it out, and you know what they did? Whatever they pleased to put a stop to terrorism. But as soon as Israel makes any effort to stop terrorism by attacking one Arab, they never go after a civilian. They're going after the heads of the organizations that are killing Jews. The Hamas and the Hezbollah, those are the organizations. They go after those heads who are killing Jews every day.
But and civilians die too, of course. It happens there.
You could say that about every war.
Yes, you can, and we have.
If you're killing people on the street corners of Israel every day without any provocation, Israel never provoked this. Israel never decided to go kill people for nothing. All these wars against Israel that took place with the Arabs were always provoked by the Arabs who wanted to invade Israel, destroy Israel. Israel never once started a war against an Arab country. Without provocation, Israel never went any place to kill anybody.
But what's the answer? I read here, Jackie Mason, in a column that I guess you did with Rove Felder, saying, we will never win this war unless we immediately threaten to drive every Arab out of Israel if the killing doesn't stop.
I think that's perfectly sensible. If Canadians were here killing people in Boston every day, wouldn't you make sure that they put a stop to it? If there was even one Canadian left here and they were still killing people in Boston, you would throw the Canadians out of the country.
But they
don't have a moral right to be here, and you have to worry about which one is going to kill you.
But don't these people have to live together sooner or later?
They have to live together, but if we have to live together, stop killing me. Is that too much to ask? Only thing Israel is asking, stop killing Jews. Every time there's peace for a week or two or three, all you hear is what happened that broke up the situation was the Arabs went into a certain village, a neighborhood, a coffee shop, and killed 300 Jews.
I want to ask you something that goes
to... Did you ever hear the peace situation broken because Israel went to kill Arabs in a candy store? I never heard of it once. Israel doesn't go around killing people in bus terminals. Israel was killed after they killed 20 Jews at a bus station. We go after the head of the Al-Qaeda. As soon as we kill the head of the Al-Qaeda, they kill another 400 Jews.
In what way is
the moral equivalency any different between America and any other terrorist organization? Why are we more righteous than they?
I want to ask you. We had on this show, it's a few months ago now, but our listeners will remember, a Palestinian comedian named Ray Hanania.
Yeah.
And Ray told a story, and I don't know if I've got it right or not, but that he was supposed, as I recall, to open for you at a club in Chicago. And as Ray tells it, you tell me your view, but as Ray tells it, you wouldn't accept him as an opening act.
Right.
Is that true?
It's not only not true, it's a fraudulent low-life story. If there was any decency in this country, a guy like that would be put in jail.
Well, he seemed like a nice, funny guy. Let me tell you something.
If you defraud a person and you demolish his reputation or attempt to destroy his reputation, it's called, blasphemy? There's a legal term for it. What do you call that when you try
slander,
to
destroy, slander?
Slander. So what happened? Blatant slander. In other countries.
But he didn't get the job. We know that.
But wait,
why?
Wait. Let me tell you what happened. Okay. This is my introduction to the fact that it was slander.
The wind up and the
pitch. This is my development of the story. The simple fact is that I personally hired him knowing that he was a Palestinian. He conveniently left out that part of the story because that kills his accusation and his attempt to get publicity at my expense.
Okay.
Because I'm a star.
So why didn't he come on?
Wait. These are good questions, except for the fact that you're talking too fast for me to finish your sentence.
Okay.
Now, I don't know where you studied how to be an interviewer, but the trick of an interview is let a guy finish your sentence first.
Our time is going.
So what do you think happens? I hired him knowing he's a Palestinian, and I was happy to. I don't feel a Palestinian shouldn't work for a living because he's a Palestinian any more than a Jew should be thrown out. So what do you think happened? After I hired him, they found out when they started advertising his name, all the Jews in the area found out that he has written columns. He was a public relations man who was writing columns in all the papers that are full of hate for Jews. He had compared Eric Sharon to Adolf Hitler, and he said Jews should be driven out of the area, and he did this hundreds of times in different kinds of columns. And he was a paid personality from certain Arab organizations that are involved with the Hezbollah and other violent groups. And he's an out-and-out violent Jewish hater.
And so,
when they found out about it, all the Jews started campaigning to get him off the stage.
And
they attacked the club. And the owners themselves got panicky because they knew they'd be out of business in an hour if they tried to keep him there. They didn't know anything about his history. So when they threw him out, he said, ha-ha, Jackie Mason threw me out because I was a Palestinian. That's an out-and-out fraud and a lie, and the fact that this man is still walking around without being in jail is only a testament to the fact that democracy doesn't work.
There is another slice on the truth, folks. George is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm a big Jackie Mason fan, and my question is regarding the infamous Ed Sullivan show of many years ago. And was that reflective of the Ed Sullivan show or perhaps the media at the time that was perhaps a little anti-Semitic in terms of Jackie Mason?
Jackie, it's what happened with your career after this incident. As Gerald Nachman describes it in his book, Seriously Funny, he says you went into a kind of 20 years in the comedy wilderness.
Right.
Did Ed Sullivan have that power? Were you kind of sent out? What happened?
Well, I would say that it basically destroyed my career for at least 20 years.
Ed,
not
personally,
because
how?
He didn't make an effort to destroy my career, but he was the symbol of the most important TV show on television.
Yeah.
He was the hottest commodity, and all of America was watching him on a Sunday. Almost like a religion. After Milton Berle, it was Ed Sullivan. That was the hot situation for everybody. And if Ed Sullivan announced, he was like the high priest of the industry. It's as if the Pope called you a lowlife. Is anybody going to listen to you? You're finished the minute he announces it. And he called me a lowlife for giving him the finger, and he didn't stop to wonder if he was right or wrong. He just was so offended and infuriated, he didn't even stop to look at what he did. And 10 seconds later, I was out of business. He actually had me back on his show about a year and a half later, apologizing to the public that he misunderstood me.
But it didn't work.
Didn't work, because nobody even noticed that part of it.
So what turned the tide? What brought Jackie Mason into the limelight?
My one-man show in New York and in London. When I came to London to play the Royal Command performance for the Queen, and the those shows were all taped and played all over America, those one-hour specials that I had in London, and everybody heard about my huge success in London, that I was the Queen Mother's favorite Jewish comedian. And then I came to the United States 17 years ago and started to do a one-man show on Broadway, and I got phenomenal raves and reviews and 2 Tony Awards and 2 Emmy Awards, and all of a sudden people who felt I was too Jewish, a Jew always feels you're too Jewish until they love you in London.
And then you're just wonderful. Right. Then you're just great.
A Gentile first has to tell them that I'm acceptable before a Jew could watch me.
Jackie, we don't have to go yet, but I want to make sure that I get across to our listeners who may be in the Boston area that Jackie and his one-man show, Prune Danish, will be performing for 4 nights at the Berklee Performance Center at Berklee College of Music in Boston from Thursday, May 15th to Sunday, May 18th. All shows start at 8 p.m., and there's more information on that and when he may be coming to your town at our website, onpointradio.org. Jackie Mason, Homeland Security, color coding system, does it work for you?
Oh, I do a whole routine about the color coding system. I don't know who told you about
it. We got 40 seconds. Give us a little lick.
But this is too funny. I'm not going to give this away for nothing. For this, they have to pay. Everything else I told you for these prices. But I'm not going to give away my best jokes, because as soon as they hear that, they'll say, well, I heard them already. Why should I pay to see it when I heard it for nothing? I got all kinds of hot jokes about security, about Iraq, about Bush, about the whole situation going on all over the world, about the preposterous nature of the Democratic candidates, and all the ways that Bush is still trying trying to learn how to talk English and all these things. But this is my act. And if you think you get it for nothing, you're getting paid here. I'm not.
Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here from Jackie Mason. Jackie, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Why not?
Jackie Mason, in a moment, a first-person account of Seattle's simulated dirty bomb attack. This is On Point. On Monday, the same day that a deadly terrorist attack rocked Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, American officials launched a week-long terrorism drills in Chicago and Seattle. In Seattle, a simulated radioactive dirty bomb was detonated downtown, and emergency workers were called in to rescue and treat the hundreds of volunteers who acted as victims. The scene eerily resembled Riyadh. There was an explosion, cars were set on fire, victims moaned for help. Even a mock TV news crew broke through police barriers to get a better view of the story. Seattle resident Vivian Chamberlain played a woman who was so near to the explosion that she lost her hearing. In this radio diary, she tells her story of acting out the role of a victim in a dirty bomb attack.
The explosion happened just after noon, and Seattle police responded within a few minutes. The police were the first to respond, and because I was a deaf person, I had a hard time communicating, and when I was being told to sit down or walk over there, I had to act as if I didn't understand, and yelling and screaming with my hands covering my ears. So they were pretty frustrated with me, but I eventually was moved out of the site. From that area, we were taken through what they call DECON, which stands for decontamination. We were sprayed with a fire hose that was not on full blast, but doused us pretty good with water. And then we waited in another line to continue with decontamination, which was more like a shower. They had a large tent set up. And then sent to another line where we removed our clothes and were triaged. And while we were sitting in the triage tent, police officers were actually walking around questioning people about what had happened. Did we see anything suspicious? Who was I with? What was I doing down there? Things like that. And when the police officer came to question me, of course I couldn't hear him because I was deaf, and they then noticed the blood that was coming from my ears and decided I needed immediate attention. I was scared to be near the fire. The fire was hot, obviously. I was very close to one of the car fires. The glass started blowing from the car windows. The tires started burning, which caused a heavy dark smoke. And then going through the decontamination at the hospital was really scary. It was a lot different than the decontaminations we went through at the site. They really didn't know what was happening. And the water was really cold and very uncomfortable. You know, I was in a bathing suit around people that I didn't know, and I didn't know what they were doing. So I wasn't in fear during the decontamination, but I was really confused. I mean, real life, real world, I was confused and a little uncomfortable because of what they were doing. I thought it took a long time to go through the process. There was a lot of people confused as to why we were standing in line. I was confused as to what we were waiting for. As far as when we were waiting to go through decontamination, we were waiting to go through triage. And there was a lot of people there. And I think everybody that was part of the drill, including myself, was very patient. And in a real-life situation, I probably wouldn't have been so patient. I would have had a lot more questions. Why are you doing this? Why is this necessary? And when we did ask questions, sometimes the officers and firefighters didn't know. They didn't know what was going to happen next. And I think that's good because if this is a drill, it's good that we did this drill because they can pinpoint those areas that might need more attention. I think all in all, they worked really well together, the different agencies, and hopefully the drill will help them be more prepared to communicate with the general public and citizens that might be affected. Going through this experience, I feel a little more comfortable knowing that people are trained, and although the process probably has a few glitches, all in all, it's comforting to know that people know what to do in that kind of situation.
Vivian Chamberlain was a volunteer in this week's mock terrorism drills. She lives in Seattle, Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian Oriental Rug.